Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive with me, Stephen. As you can see, I'm all by myself because Tiffany is off on a break. But today we're going to talk about something that, you know, is close to the heart of many of us living here in Singapore, and that's got to do with food. Let me list out a few names, see if you can recognize them. Warung Nasi Pariaman, The Providor, Lola. Yep, these are just some of the F&B outlets that have shut their doors this year, and it's only, what, 3 months into the year. All three have different concepts, they serve different customers, but all met the same fate. And it seems to be more common and common in Singapore. Give you some numbers, in 2024 alone, more than 3,000 F&B outlets closed. That's the highest number in nearly two decades. Reasons, familiar, they say rising rents, higher operating costs, shortage of manpower, customer habits have changed too. But even as doors close, many new restaurants are coming onto the scene. In 2025, more than 4,000 new F&B businesses were registered, even as about 3,000, or rather over 3,000 outlets closed. So what is it about Singapore that makes, you know, the F&B scene so volatile? And even though things can get rough, why do entrepreneurs, both local, foreign, keep coming back for more? Do they enjoy the pain, the agony, the challenge? I don't know. We're going to find out because I have one of them with me today. Mustafa Kamal is the co-founder of the Black Hole Group, the team behind restaurants Tipo Pasta Bar and Ella.
That's right.
And also Debbie Yong is a restaurant industry watcher and a brand strategist.
Hi.
Mustafa, I was just talking about someone like you, you know, the people who open and close F&B outlets, but, you know, you've been in the industry for 13 years, had your own ups and downs, I dare say. What is the most difficult part about running an F&B establishment?
F&B industry is very challenging, not because to pour a glass of water is rocket science, it's just that it's little actions like pouring a glass of water, making sure the aircon is right, the music is playing, the staff turn up on time, the food is fresh. All of that, a million things happening all at once, simultaneously. It takes one thing for it to go wrong. Ah. All that, simultaneously, to sell a burger that is $10. So you have to sell thousands and thousands of that to make money.
Okay.
So it takes one thing to go wrong. So that's why F&B is so complicated. And you do it for 6 months and do it for a year and you think you've got the formula right. You've got the formula right, the economic condition changes next year. Mm. Trends change, consumer behavior change, and then you have to adapt to that again. So you have to find that rhythm, that formula to deal with that.
There's no template that you can say, okay, it worked for this restaurant, let me just multiply it for all my different outlets.
There is no general template. So I would say it would be naive to think, when you talk about the F&B industry, it would be very naive to think that F&B is just F&B.
Okay.
You've got for local food, you've got local food in the hawker centres, you've got local food in the food courts, you've got local food in the food courts in the neighbourhood, you have got local food in standalone shop houses, and they all operate differently. Obviously, the general model is rent, manpower, cost of goods, utilities, generally like that. But the dynamics of the P&L differs from business model to business model.
Yeah, and I guess the guy, you know, eating in Ion versus the guy in Bishan, you know, slightly different crowd, different expectations. And ironically, it just occurred to me, your group is called the Black Hole Group. It almost feels like, do you ever feel that things are just like,
all the time,
sinking into a black hole?
Things are disappearing all the time, getting broken all the time.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, Debbie, let's get to you because you were covering, you were a journalist, you know, and covering the business aspect of, you know, the F&B industry in Singapore.
Yes, indeed.
What's the main trend you have noticed?
So I've been writing about the restaurant industry since 2010. So that's just after the IRS opened. So I really saw the different waves of development of the industry. And I think my general takeaway is that everything is cyclical. Sometimes it feels like this is the worst we've ever seen. But actually, when you look back at the longer trajectory, there have been cycles, right? And that even predates me, predates the IRs, right? There are like periods of ups and downs. And I think that sometimes as a business owner, it's easy to sit and say, oh, this is the worst we've ever seen. But actually, there were lower dips as well, that, you know, there was SARS. And actually, I lived in Hong Kong for a while and I also covered the F&B industry there. And actually, the restaurant owners there tell me some of the best concepts, the most enduring brands today were started during SARS because they started at the most difficult time, right? So their survival, they were built with very little cushioning. And so, yeah, there were periods that you know, restaurants have picked up from, and so it's not the worst.
So you're saying now what all the F&B outlets here in Singapore are facing, you're saying it's not the worst?
It's not the worst, and I think there are lots that we can unpack from there.
Okay.
And I think one thing when looking at closures is that the reasons for closures are not homogenous. We see a lot of coverage and a lot of hoo-ha over the closures, right? Every time. And a lot of them are very much loved chains that, you know, heritage brands that have been around. And people are always like, oh, you know, it's so sad. It must be rent. It must be terrible landlords, right? It must be, oh, labor is really hard to find. So government, you need to give us better policies to hire foreign workers. But actually, there are many reasons why restaurants close. Sometimes it's private ones. It's partnership disputes.
Yeah.
And I know of some restaurants that have been named where they say, oh, rent is the reason. And I know privately it's not. But the restaurant owner is not going to say, oh, I fell out with my partner, because that's just a bad look, right?
Yeah, John and Jenny didn't get along, but you don't want to tell the whole world.
Sometimes it's funds have invested in the group,
PE
funds, and they have no sentimentality, right? They're like, okay, the numbers either make sense or not, or we cut service.
Oh,
we cut,
I mean, okay, that's fair. If you're a business and I've invested in you and I'm telling you either you make money, the moment you don't, or you don't give me a certain percentage returns, then forget it, not worth my time, right?
Yeah.
So that's one aspect. But coming back to the issue of rent, because that has been one thing that many, you know, entrepreneurs have cried foul and said, you know, it's crazy rent. So in your experience, how true is that?
First of all, I actually agree with Debbie that, it's naive to think that rent is the main culprit. In fact, it undermines our conversation. It simplifies our conversation to be like, huh, just rent is not. Because rent has always been a challenge.
Right.
Even before the pandemic, even before...
So it's not more of a challenge than it was in the past?
It's more of a challenge because of the combination of all the other factors. All the other factors, meaning... the slight increase in GST, the strong Singapore dollar, the increase in number of openings in Singapore simultaneously, the changing consumer behavior, the fact that right back in the day when you want to eat food, you either go out or you go out, tapau, bring home. Today you have food delivery,
many other options,
platforms. So they also take a cut, a commission.
Yeah. But one would imagine rent is like what, at least 30%?
It really depends on the operator. Like a lot of the operators I know, they operate between 18 to 21%. That is a kind of the sweet spot. If they can do it lower, that is better. Anything, to me, anything above 20, 25 is very slippery slope already.
Yeah, so a restaurant owner once told me, rent is a significant cost, but it's something you can control. At the point of signing the lease, if you have done your math, right, you can say, okay, my rent shouldn't be more than X percentage of the business. I think the issue now is, well, the general challenge in Singapore is that the F&B industry operates on very thin margins compared to a lot of the rest of the world, right? Like 5, 10% if you're lucky for profit. And when you do your math, okay, so rent 20%, but you can't control the revenue. So once revenue dips because consumer behavior has changed, then rent becomes a significant, a much bigger portion.
So if your rent is 20,000 and then as the business owner, you've measured it. To make money, you need to hit $100,000 in revenue.
Right.
For 3 years, all good. After that, recession happens or whatnot. The revenue goes down. So now your rent is 20,000 out of 90,000. It's not 20% anymore, 20+%. That's one thing. Another thing is that typically the tenancy laws in Singapore, the tenancy culture in Singapore, we sign 3 years.
Yeah.
3+3. And after the first 3 years, the landlord is not just going to like, okay, you're doing all right, I'm getting my rent, so it's going to be an increment. Some landlords, they have a longer term view and relationship with the tenants. They say, you know what, I'm going to increase by 5 to 10%. Some, and I know this for a fact because, you know, we interact with other owners, get an increment of about 30, 50%. Not uncommon. Not uncommon. So when that happens, that messes up the whole P&L.
Yeah.
You cannot just tap out and say, you know what, in that case, I move on, because you've already invested capital into rent.
So do you feel that's unfair?
From the operator's perspective, it can seem unfair. But if you expand the frame, if you are the landlord, you'd think it's perfectly fair.
I would be landlord saying, well, shouldn't you have anticipated that I would increase rent? Because it just makes sense. Every year, things get more expensive, right?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's the property also changes hands. And, you know, when we pull back and look at the Singapore investment landscape, right, there's a lot of foreign money coming in. And because we have such tight controls over investing in residential property, residential real estate, a lot of this money is now going to commercial real estate. And so sometimes, you know, when the shop house or, you know, whatever the property changes hands at a much higher price, naturally the landlord, the new landlord who bought it at the higher price is going to jack up. So can you blame them for wanting, and it's an investment for them as well, right? But that's it. I think there are also opportunistic landlords who have remained throughout, right? And then want to jack up the rent.
In general, you're saying rent is one aspect, but it's not the only thing that sort of really kills the business. So when I, you know, those names I mentioned earlier, you know, those guys, why do you think they've been around, their favorites long? You know, I always figure if a company or F&B outlet closes within a year, within 2 years, I'm like, okay, fair enough.
You tried.
It didn't make sense. They tried, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But these guys have been around for years, and then suddenly, does it mean they've given it their all and still thought this just doesn't make sense anymore?
With a lot of these brands that have been around, I think the point is the challenge is innovation. How do you translate, or how do you keep what works but still stay fresh and exciting?
Okay.
And I think a lot of these brands, you know, they, you know, I also consult with some companies on their branding and their narrative, and they say, okay, I've been around 20 years. I'm not the hottest kid on the block. I want to try and target this new Gen Z audience, but I have so much at stake because I have all my old customers and I can't pivot immediately. I will lose them. But then I also still want to be fresh and exciting. And I think maybe some of the older brands maybe took for granted that they are established, they're always going to be loved. They never maybe did like sentiment analysis. They never talked to their customers. They never tried to ask the new customers, why are you coming to us? The old ones, why are you still here? What do you love about us? How do we keep you coming back? And I think also a lot of businesses always launch new campaigns. They're always trying to get new customers, but they forget actually the people who love them. There's still a lot to, you know, build communities around them, engage them in different ways, build experiential touch points for that.
Even for the brands I you know, I like, the places I like going to, I always assume that they would have like an online presence, they would have takeaway, or they would have, you know, ready packed meals, that kind of thing. But then I realized in some cases they didn't. And I was like, you mean you don't, you know? And that surprised me. So is that one of the reasons too? I mean, have some of them failed to stay relevant, or have they also not diversified enough?
There are heritage brands in Singapore that has evolved, and at some point in time, whether it be it by chance or the visionary founder, they've diversified their portfolios. They're not just running F&B, they own buildings. Yeah. They own a portfolio of properties as well.
Ah.
And when you run a business like an F&B business, you are day-to-day sucked into the ground, solving operational problems. Okay. You don't have time to really step back and strategize on a 10-year roadmap.
Shouldn't that be the way? I mean, if I want to start a business, I mean, I would think, 10 years from now, where will I be? What are my goals? What are my objectives each year? What are my milestones? Shouldn't all that be planned out before you start something?
I think the problem with a lot of the new entrants and why we're seeing so many new openings is that people think, oh, I've eaten in a restaurant and this could be better. I'm just going to open my own. And they haven't done the homework. And that's it. Even those who have done the homework, you know, market conditions change, as Mustafa was saying. So you need to have annual reviews of what is this 10-year plan. And, you know, like you're saying, I think the people are just too busy firefighting.
Are some of these new businesses coming in just, they haven't mapped out and thought about how far they could go, how long their 300,000 will last, and, you know, done the math?
I think that's exactly it. So I was also looking at investing in a restaurant a while ago. So I spent 15 years covering the industry. Okay. And now when people ask me, should I go in the industry? I tell them, no.
Okay.
But recently I met a chef, a young chef, very, very ambitious, a lot of good potential. So we thought of investing. And we did, because we were pitching for a government property, so you have to submit a 3-year plan.
Okay.
And we actually went beyond that, looked at a 6-year plan, did all the math, did the financials, a whole spreadsheet and all of that. And then we realized the math ain't mathing. Like, it's just hard to make the numbers. And if you change a couple of numbers, and I think a lot of people don't do this, they assume, they calculate for the best case scenario.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But you don't calculate for the worst case. What if nobody comes into your restaurant?
Yeah.
What is your runway? And we math it all out. You know, it was about 2 or 3 months. So 2 to 3 months, if nobody comes in at all, business tanks, that's all we had. And I realized, okay, it's a very risky investment. And I was talking to, actually, interestingly, a owner of another restaurant group, and he thinks that actually rental terms, the rental leases, should be increased to 10 years so that it sets the barrier to entry much higher. So people actually raise enough capital, right, to have a long enough runway to actually do the sums and say, can I be in this for 10 years? Then should I reasonably go into this industry? What are my safeguards? And for me, I did it for 3 years and already I thought, okay, it's really hard to survive. So, you know, kudos to you for surviving for so long, but I did not have the guts to do it.
10 years is a bit long, but I think 3 years is a good gauge. And ironically, you said it was because it's a government renting from the government. So they asked for that proposal, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's not always the case in private commercial entities, right? They don't really care about your
plan. They don't.
Just pay me X amount if you can, go for it, man.
When restaurants and cafes open and they close, they're not just opening and closing. In the period that they're open, they are disrupting the current players, the serious players in the market. They are diluting the market. Yeah, even if they open and nobody comes in, or a few people come in for 3 months, 6 months, you're already messing up the dynamics for the labor market, because now you're to share with the new players, you're sharing customers.
Yeah,
you are giving landlords the idea that hey, there's a demand for my property. Last guy paid me 30,000. Even though he closed shop within 6 months, doesn't matter. My next tenant must pay me 30,000 or more because he set the standard, right?
So do we have too many F&B outlets? Can that be a situation where have we gone past the sweet spot? The sweet spot being where everybody has just enough manpower, everything's like hunky-dory, and now this new guy, the new five guys come in, you're like, come on, guys, you just messed up the whole equation.
It sure does feel like it. I can't,
I think so.
I can't know for sure, but it does feel like it.
Firstly, yes, I totally agree. I think there are too many restaurants, too many F&B outlets that our little island can support. And I think that something that really skews the market is some restaurants are vanity projects.
Oh.
They are not started to earn money, right? It's the billionaire, millionaire who thinks, I just want a private dining room. I want to entertain my friends. I want somewhere to store my wines. Mm. And if I can have a couple friends in and make an extra buck for a couple of extra people coming in, why not, right? So then they come in, they compete for the labor, they pay the rent that, you know, skews the market,
but
the
can't
landlord's
be that
expectations.
Many of them to really disrupt the market.
But they can be one player can disrupt the entire market. So a few years ago, I won't mention it, there was a coffee chain that operated in Singapore, and I think they were not making money, but it doesn't matter because not all businesses are here for money, right?
Yeah.
They're here to build a brand, 3-year runway,
especially foreign brands coming in, right?
And
this is their loss leader.
And then change hands, you know? And it's not uncommon.
But they had planned out. They're like, I know I'm going to lose $1 million a year on this, you know?
Yeah, so sink more money in, more money in. 3 years, get a buyer to elevate the entire
business. So how do you feel about these large foreign chains coming in and, you know?
Again, I think it depends on where you sit, you know. From a national perspective, I think it's necessary. We can't close our doors on, because a small country like Singapore, we rely on a lot of foreign investments coming into Singapore, companies coming into Singapore to sustain and grow economically.
Yep.
So we cannot close our doors on these companies. But at the same time, if you're an operator inside, you're kind of forced to innovate and adapt.
Okay.
If not, you just be left behind. Heritage or not, loved or not, doesn't matter.
I mean, to be fair, heritage or not, why should I come and patronize your shop just because you're a heritage?
You know,
if your food's not so great anymore, your service is crap, then
I think, these brands need to still be consumer-centric, right? Are you still offering good value? Are you, you know, being fun? Are you memorable? Do you make people want to come back?
Right.
And I think with the foreign chains coming in, highly unpopular opinion, I'm probably going to get flamed after this, but I think we need to turn the heat up on our local operators, right? Because our market is so small that if you build a brand just for Singapore, ultimately, you're just going to cannibalize each other.
Correct.
And if we want Singaporean brands to go overseas, they need to learn to compete with these foreign players. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about, should government, protect the local businesses? If we raise these unnatural, unrealistic protectionism, safeguards, then we are mollycoddling our businesses, right? And the day they expand overseas, they're not going to survive because it's so much more competitive.
So then comes the question, some say, well, government should help us. Some say government should help local businesses, survive a bit better, step up and give some more support in terms of grants, maybe even subsidies for rental, things like that. What's your response to that?
I think it's a bit dangerous if we slide into this handout mentality of, ultimately it's a business, right? If you go into business, you take all the upside, but you also have to risk the downside. That's not an entrepreneurial mindset if you think, somebody's going to bail me out when we don't do well. I think, yes, it's tough. And yes, I have all the sympathy for restaurant owners, but you need to sometimes look at your own business before saying, oh, bail me out, please.
I feel like the government should consider helping, but not in the form of handouts.
Okay, then how?
I think we should really put our money where our mouth is. Support local businesses, not for the sake of it, but because we are proud of our culture and our heritage. But don't, you know, like, all Singapore businesses, all of you get
but
money.
But support how?
As in,
no, exactly. I think
as in we, customers?
No.
I mean, then
the government. The government, oh. Yeah. Because these are brands made in Singapore, groomed in Singapore, but you need to have certain criteria. They need to have a good product. They need to have been operating in 10 years, for example, in Singapore. They need to prove that the business is viable. Yeah. Then we can talk about serious. And they really have this kind of platform like Helicornia, where they invest in certain companies.
You're saying that now there is an inter-agency task force to support heritage businesses. So I think that the instrument to support the F&B industry cannot be a blunt one where everyone gets subsidies because it's not homogenous. Some, you know, are vanity projects. But so it needs to be very specific. And I think that is a good, you know, let's fund the heritage businesses, or let's give them the schemes. So it needs to be finer instruments than just, oh, government, give me subsidies.
Right. In fact, I'm thinking they should look at that as a government, as if the government were a VC, you know, who's investing in your business, and say, well, let me prove to you why you should partner with me to take my business overseas. Let me give you my goal, my plan, and how I see this mapping out, you know. And then that way it's not sort of saying, oh, government help me, and then just getting funding. But you've proved that you can do something and you have a vision.
Yeah. And I guess just as a thought starter, and also just to challenge the points that we were talking about, actually, is the yardstick sending all businesses overseas? Maybe it isn't, right? Maybe it's keeping the heritage business alive in Singapore for the next 20 years. And then the yardstick is then, what is your roadmap, your 20-year roadmap to just stay active, relevant, to digitalize, you know, to adapt to AI? It's going to need to be very bespoke almost. It can't be just, how do you filter, right?
It can't be just numbers driven.
So it's not like CDC vouchers for us, give it to every F&B.
Yeah, no,
you know? Here's $200 you can spend at restaurants and, you know,
as a taxpayer, I also don't want my money to be going to people who don't need it, right? I don't want to fund vanity projects, right? I also want to see that the tax I'm paying is being spent prudently, with results, and to support causes that make me proud as a Singaporean. Often we think about government support as monetary, but there's a lot more, right, in maybe creating community associations, learning journeys, sending, you know, as the restaurant association does,
global exposure as well.
Learning journeys, you go to China, you see how they learn and do it. So often we're always just waiting for the government to throw money at us, but it could be a lot of other things as well. Mentorship programs within the industry.
So it sounds like we need to, more exposure, I guess, because you learn from others, right?
I think when a lot of these restaurants and restaurant groups close, they close quietly and then they just don't talk about it. And I'm a busybody and I'm a journalist and all, right? So I'm like, why? What's the real reason rather than just the blanket pretty reason? And if we encourage a culture of being open about failure, right? Like if we got some of these restaurant owners to say, this is what I messed up. This is what I should have done 5 years ago to better position myself. But I think this needs a completely societal mindset change where we say, okay, there's no shame in saying you close your restaurant. That is a form of self-preservation. That's a business decision as well. Closing a restaurant is an astute business decision. It's not always failure. It's not always terrible. Maybe some people just locked in their profits and they think, you know, I'm getting old. My kids don't want to take over. I'm just going to cash out, right? And and have a happy retirement. I don't want to slog forever.
So it could be a strategic decision.
Yeah, exactly.
It could
be many reasons. Yeah. Okay, we're just going to wrap up. So very quickly, your take, I mean, on the F&B scene today and how you see it planning out in the next, maybe let's say 3 years from now. Where do you think we'll be? Is it going to be better, worse, or just as scary?
It remains to be seen. So it's really down to the F&B players to sharpen, try to increase the top line, tighten things up, manage the cost. I think it's going to be a rough season ahead.
Rough season ahead, and it could only get worse. May not get...
It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. But like Debbie said, it's cyclical. Everything that goes down must go up, and everything that goes up must come down. So yeah, you just gotta rough it
buckle,
out.
Buckle
just...
up and enjoy the ride.
Debbie, what do you think?
I think that we should not be afraid of volatility because volatility is what gives Singapore its vibrancy, right? And if we say we have a very dynamic F&B scene, that's actually what attracts everyone to come and dine here, because you don't want to come to Singapore and, oh, it's the same old restaurants. Yeah, you know, when I go to Europe, right? True. And like the cities never change, the restaurants are still there. And sometimes it's a terrible restaurant, like in, you know, in the neighborhood. So some of this renewal is a good thing. And I think for businesses, it's also in this very volatile times, it's actually holding your customers very close, like surveying them, talking to them, yeah. creating loyalty programs, what they actually want. And for the customers, I think it's supporting your businesses. Because often you hear online, right, everyone writes these long eulogies when a restaurant group closed and they say, oh, I went there 5 years ago and I really miss it. I'm like, well, where were you for the last 5 years?
Maybe.
So go back often. If something's not right, give private feedback. And I mean, you know, online.
Don't just give a one-star rating and complain online.
Exactly. I mean, that's a whole other topic. But you tell them how you can improve. Tell them your needs so that they can design around you as a consumer as well.
I mean, we got very fussy customers here in Singapore. You know, I admit, yeah. But I do love great service. And I'm willing to pay a bit more if you get better service. Because so many times I felt, even though I'm paying so much, then you get this crap service and you're like, okay, I'm never coming back here again.
Yeah. You're going to drive up restaurant prices a bit more nowadays.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, good stuff. Just smile. Say hello, you know. Thank you, you know. And don't charge for water. Never mind. That's a whole different discussion. Okay. On that note, we want to say thanks to our guests for coming in and sharing their thoughts on this issue. I mean, we love our food. We love dining out and enjoying, you know, that lifestyle. So let us know what you think about it. What do you think about your favorite outlet closing down, or you know, and how do you feel we can support them better, in what way? So let us know your thoughts. We do love to hear from you. But otherwise, that's it for this week's episode of Deep Dive. We'll see you again next week. Bye for now.